And there we have it, a still photo of Maverick and a live shot of Maverick. Unbelievable.
Eric, we got
how you doing, Scott?
I'm doing good, thank yourself.
I'm at the top of my game, can't you tell? And how's Maverick? Maverick looks happy.
Maverick is, he just came from a walk, so he's very happy. I picked him up because he was getting ready to bark, and I didn't want the show to start with barking dogs. They may bark later on in the show, but I was trying to preempt it. So, Maverick, say hello. Now say goodbye.
Be all quiet. Right. Maybe you could hold Maverick the whole time, no?
I think that would be unfair to him. He's an active dog. He likes to move.
Oh, I got it. All right.
He's like his owner. Doesn't want to be tied down. But here I am, tied down.
Do you hear that phone ringing? I got to stop that. I'm hearing a phone ring on my computer.
Might be the president trying to call you.
No. You don't hear it, right? Oh, good. All right. It's driving me a little crazy. Hopefully it'll stop ringing soon. Okay. So you have a new article out, and it's in Energy Intelligence. Game changer. That's a phrase that's come up before, how China's Iran-Saudi deal transforms geopolitics. And we were just talking a little bit about energy intelligence before we came on. And, you know, we were talking from time to time, it comes up like, what's a good source? How do people get good information? And this is something that's kind of geared for oil industry professionals, right? What about the average person? Anybody can just log on and read this. Would you recommend this publication?
I highly recommend it. I mean, and not because they let me write for them. I mean, that's an honor and a privilege. But I've had a relationship with Energy Intelligence and its management for almost 20 years now. And these guys, you know, it's not just an energy publication. It's the energy publication. Understand that this publication goes to every CEO of every major oil company in the world. If you're in the oil gas business, this is it. They run a conference every year called Oil and Money. And that's what it's about, oil and money and the world. And it's attended by everybody, the who's who. But here's the thing. I mean, even though it's geared towards the energy security, you know, the energy security audience, the energy professionals, energy is such an important part of what we do in the world today. And so even if you're not somebody who works for an oil company or is investing in, you know, downstream, production or, you know, upstream or all the other terms that they throw out there, you want to read this because you'll have your finger on the pulse. I will say that they're a conservative organization. And what I mean by that is you're not going to be led too far astray with any of their analysis. Their analysis will be fact-based and will not, I've been reined in by their editors sometimes, not because I'm loose with the facts, but because I tend to take a set of facts and then extrapolate broadly. And they're like, whoa, back boy. We'll let you go to the fence line, but we're not going to let you go over the horizon on this one. And that's okay because that's the nature of the beast.
I think that's what would make it an especially good source. I mean, these oil industry professionals aren't into like playing favorites politically. They want to know real analysis. They want to know exactly what's going to happen. Yeah.
It's the dollar. I mean, oil and money. They're not into, playing politics unless the politics, increases their bottom line. I don't mean to make it sound too crass because it's not. I mean, look, these guys are on the forefront of green energy. Energy Intelligence has taken the lead in trying to promote, a green energy and conversion. They're, one of the original brain trusts of this was the guy who predicted peak oil and saying, we got to find another solution to oil. We've got to find something else besides oil. So the idea that Energy Intelligence is about greedy oil men trying to stick it to the world in order to squeeze out another, absolutely false. It is a broad-based, broad-spectrum, group. It's a publishing group, and they have different, different publications that they put out. In addition, they've just, they've entered the modern world. So the Energy Intelligence website, you can log in. There's a lot of free product in there, guys, a lot of free product.
Well, you know what? Whether they're greedy or not, they want to know what to expect. I mean, that's the bottom line. That's why I think it would be a good
start. But some people would hesitate and say, well, I'm not going to support oil. I mean, Jeff, you and I ran into it. Remember when we were talking to the left about broadening the anti-war coalition and how important it would be to actually get the people who are going to lose billions of dollars because of this war to be on the anti-war side? And the progressives went, we'll never work with those oil people, those dirty, dirty oil people. Well, I'm here to tell you right now that the publication that advises the dirty, dirty oil people produces some of the best, it's Energy Intelligence. This is some of the best analysis out there, and everybody would be well served plugging into it. You don't have to, at the end of the day, again, like anything, you don't have to walk away and say, oh, I agree because it's published in Energy Intelligence. But if you walk away and say, I don't agree, it's because you're thinking about what they wrote in Energy Intelligence. It challenged you, and then you were forced to confront the issues, et cetera. But I also find that while you may challenge conclusions, you'll never challenge the facts. They are assiduous with the facts, and that's important.
Yeah. I don't know if anybody, you talked about they don't want to work with these people. I don't know anybody who considers reading and analysis in this publication working with them. They got some serious problems. All right. So before we get to the questions, this is the lightning round, so we don't want to gab for too long. But just briefly, what is significant? You say this is a game changer. What's the game changer?
Well, look, since time immemorial, i.e. World War II, the United States has been using Saudi Arabia as its go-to source for oil. And hello, Tbilisi. Garma Joba. That means hello in Georgian. I'm saying hello to the person from Tbilisi. My wife would be very proud. I can also say Rogla Rachart. That means how are you? And then my Georgian terminates. But the point is Saudi Arabia and the United States have had a very close relationship that has been economic-based and security-based. And it became even more closely linked in the 70s after the oil crisis, the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, fears of Soviet incursion into Iran, the Iran-Iraq war. And so the United States, you know, started this policy of, you know, we're going to protect the oil in the Persian Gulf. That's how we got involved in the Gulf War. You know, we created something called the Rapid Deployment Force back in the late 1970s. I was part of the Marine Corps component of that when I was in 29 Palms with a go bag ready to fly in. And hello, Bulgaria. And I'm saying hello to everybody. Hello, UK. Okay, we'll stop. But hello, everybody. But the point is, you know, it was real. And we had this link that got us involved in the Gulf War, and it got us involved in the whole decade of the, you know, of the 90s in Iraq. It was all based upon our relationship with Saudi Arabia protecting it. And even after 9/11, the complexities of that relationship were tested by the fact that most of the Arabs who flew airplanes into buildings were Saudis, and their support for Al-Qaeda, et cetera. But it's been a relationship from the oil perspective based upon the overproduction capacity of Saudi Arabia. I don't know what it finally is, 12 million barrels a day, maybe more, but they don't produce that much. They produce less. And that means that the orders of the United States, they can increase production or decrease production depending on what impact we want to have on the global market. It's all about serving us. In exchange, we guarantee their security. That's been tested lately. Saudi Arabia feels that the United States has been abusive, not doing what needs to be done to protect Saudi Arabia. You know, the whole Iraq invasion, Afghan invasion, are we staying in the Middle East, not staying in the Middle East? And then the whole Jamal Khashoggi thing where we called the leader of Iraq or of Saudi Arabia a pariah. Joe Biden said, I will never deal with this man. I will never deal with this man until we needed oil. And then he crawled on his knees to that man. And that man told him to pound sand. That was one of the turning points. We've been trying to make Saudi Arabia the leader of a Gulf Arab wall, a bulwark against Iranian expansion in the region. Now, the Iranians would say, we're not expanding. It's just natural for us to have dealings with the Shia Crescent. And then we tried to get Israel to come on board with the Abraham Accord to join in. We wanted normalization between Saudi Arabia and Israel. We're pushing for all this. And in comes China. And China says, how about you guys make good with the Iranians and throw all that 70-year-plus history with America out of the window? And the Saudis went, we're on board. And that's what they've done. They've made good with Iran. Now, it's not a done deal. There's a lot of work left to be done, but they're heading in that direction. Not only that, they're jumping ship. They're done with the petrodollar, baby. They're joining BRICS. They're signing contracts with the Chinese, their number one buyer of oil now in yuan. And this is tectonic. This is a huge geopolitical shift that we'll never recover from. I don't think Americans have quite woken up to the fact that it's over in the Middle East, literally over. We have no reason to be there anymore because Saudi Arabia isn't playing our game anymore. They're playing the Chinese game. They're making peace with Iran. We needed them to make war with Iran. We needed to make good with Israel. Now they're saying, no, we don't want to make good with Israel. It's isolated Israel, and it's created, you know, a Chinese inroad into the Middle East that didn't exist hitherto for. That's what I mean by game changer. Just a little
all
bit.
Right. Well, I don't know if it's also a game changer, and I think we should move to the questions. But but the other thing that's on my mind is that the President Xi Jinping was just meeting with Putin. That seems significant too. But let's maybe save that for tomorrow night and just tell folks if they want to read this article, they can get to it from scottritterextra.com. We link to it. That's our Substack. While you're there, subscribe to it. All right, let's get to the questions. This is the lightning round. We usually do it on Tuesdays. Every question Scott answers in 3 minutes or less. This week, we're doing it on Wednesday. First question comes from Andy M. in Bristol. You previously stated that 7 or 8 Iraqi indigenously produced Scud missiles were never fully accounted for by UNSCOM. Do you still stand by this statement?
Yeah. Why wouldn't I? It's fact-based. Andy, were you an inspector? I don't know. Identify yourself. Were you on my teams? Were you on Nikita Smidovich's, team that was, doing the detailed forensics on it? Were you in Votkins doing the counting of the serial numbers? Were you in France doing the reverse engineering? Were you in Huntsville, Alabama doing the reverse engineering? I don't know. If you were, maybe you have an alternative set of facts. Maybe you hid some information from us and secreted out. But I was the guy that sort of ran this thing. I was involved in it. So, yeah, I'll say that while we could say we had a good idea that the Iraqis had provided an accounting for it, the way the material was disposed, for instance, when you take indigenously produced engines and you melt them into an ingot, you can't do much forensics in that ingot. So you have to weigh the ingot and make an assumption that everything's there. And so fully accounted for means 100% certainty. And I will tell you right now, there's about 7 or 8 indigenous Iraqi scuds that we cannot fully account for. Can we account for them in one way or another? Yes, we have. That's why I'm not losing any sleep over this. I don't believe there's 7 or 8 missiles floating around that we have to run away from. I'm just saying when the job description is 100% certainty, I can't fulfill that. Now, if you lowered that down to, say, 95% certainty, damn, buddy, now we're down to 100%. I'll give it to you. But that's not what the Security Council told us. They said 100%. We never got 100%. If you've got a separate set of facts that you want to put up here and challenge me on it, feel free. I'm not running away from anything. Let's go.
Yeah, who knows what's on his mind? Sort of vaguely implies that maybe you wouldn't stand by it, but I guess he expects you to refute an argument that he has failed to make.
Well, that's for me. I don't know the point of the question. I mean, it normally would be, Scott, other people have come out and said that, they haven't accounted for. Other people come out and said it's fully accounted for, but you said this. Why do you say that, and do you still stand by it? See, I can do that. But the implication of, you said this, you still stand by it. Why wouldn't I?
Macho Manos, more or less. Oh, get it? More or less. Do you think part of Russia's plan is to let Zelensky bring many more battalions to Bakhmut, so when it's time to take Odessa, they won't have troops to defend it, preventing its destruction?
That's a difficult one because, again, if we're going to say let them bring more battalions to Bakhmut, we have to recognize that those battalions come with artillery support. And the Ukrainians are putting a lot of artillery into this battle. So it's saying that in addition to us killing the Ukrainians at large numbers, we're exposing, and I'm saying this from a Russian perspective, our troops to deadly artillery fires as a result, increasing the cost. As a military commander, that what you want to do is bring closure to this battle. And I think you could actually kill more troops by completing the encirclement and annihilating what's in there than keeping it open. Because, again, you want the ratio not just to be dead Ukrainians, but you want fewer dead Russians. And so why continue a battle that's very costly for Russia? Not as costly as for the Ukrainians, but it's costly. We can't pretend that Russia's not suffering casualties, that Russia's not taking losses, that this isn't expensive for Russia. So I think from a military perspective, I can say that last thing I'd be briefing the boss is, hey, yeah, I enjoy writing those 120 letters home to moms saying your son died because what the hell, we just want the Ukrainians to grind themselves up. No problem, boss. Let's keep up that strategy. What I'd be saying is I prefer not to be writing these letters. Let's bring it into this battle, kill these son of a bitches and get on with the war. And I think that's what the Russians are trying to do. I mean, the fact is they're out there working really hard to take these heights that are, you know, to the west of Bakhmut, seal that last road, and then, you know, surround these people and hold back counterattacks from the Ukrainians. That's what they're trying to do. The Ukrainians are fighting like hell. They're losing, but they're fighting like hell. They're not going down easy. So, no, I don't think this is about the Russians being casual about this. I think the Russians are committed to this fight, fighting to win. But it's just a tough fight.
All right. You're on your old computer, aren't you, Scott?
Why do you say that?
Because the audio sucks.
There's okay. No comment, Jeff. I will neither confirm nor deny that.
Yeah, you just confirmed it. Armando Luis from Toronto. Does the odious decision by the UK government to supply Ukraine with depleted uranium munitions constitute an act of war? How will or should Russia respond?
First of all, I respect the Russian irritation at the decision by the United Kingdom to provide Ukraine with depleted uranium anti-tank rounds for the Challenger 2 tanks. Let's just set something straight. People out there are saying, well, Russia has depleted uranium. No, they don't. You see, Russia had them. The Soviet Union had depleted uranium rounds because it's a great tank killer. No doubt about that. But the Russians also looked at it and said, when we use this, we're hurting our troops and we're hurting the civilian population. It's an odious weapon. And so what they did is they literally got rid of them and they've replaced them with, I think it's a tungsten core, a titanium core penetrators. They cost more. That's one of the things. Depleted uranium is cheap. These tungsten things, they're more expensive, and they may not be as effective as depleted. And they're still good tank killers, but the round is more sophisticated. It's more expensive. But the Russians said, we're willing to pay that cost up front so we don't pay the cost down the road. United States, Great Britain, and others are saying, no, we want cheap tank killers, and we don't care about the cost of humans, the deformed babies in Iraq, the high level of leukemia in Kosovo. We don't care about that. Fact is, we work overtime to cover that up. So I understand why the Russians are irritated. But Russia's been in the business of escalation management, and they're winning this war, and this war is on the track to being finished by the end of summer, early fall. So I don't imagine that Russia's going to do anything. First of all, it's not depleted uranium. They're not radioactive. No one's saying that they are. They're a heavy metal. And when the penetrator vaporizes, as it does when it hits something hard, it vaporizes and you breathe that in, you tend to die and it tends to poison your system. And you pass it on to your wife who gets pregnant with your poisoned system. And you have deformed babies. And the babies are breathing in the dust from the soil that's taking this stuff. So it's not about radiation. It's about poison, about the toxicity of the stuff. I think the Russians are just putting this down as yet another stupid act of, criminal aggression by the West against Ukrainian people. I don't see them, taking any precipitous actions. I definitely don't see them turning this into a nuclear conflict over this. But they're putting the marker down that, you're introducing uranium weapons to the battlefield. And we prefer you didn't do that. But the West doesn't listen because the West is stupid.
Okay. We have a breaking news story. Rumors have been swirling for days that former President Trump would be indicted, and the expectation was that he would surrender in a civilized manner with the cooperation of the Secret Service and the NYPD. Apparently, that hasn't happened as expected. There you see former President Trump evading the New York Police Department as they looks like Central Park, perhaps, in the background there as they chase him. So we'll let you know how that turns out. You'd not think that Trump would be in great shape, but maybe some of these cops aren't in great shape either.
Looks well, to be I can tell you that Donald Trump's legs haven't been that thin in years. But
all right. We'll watch that. Okay. Oh, we already did that one. Thank you for the excellent use of Odious, and also appreciate the capital letters.
Odious.
Sergey. I've been getting around-the-clock tutoring from Kevin about how to pronounce that. I got that right now, finally. Yep, Sergey? Yes, I'll take your silence as a yes. St. Petersburg?
You got that.
Thank you, Kevin, and thanks for your help. Many Russian defeatist types argue that even if Russia goes to the Dnieper River, it will ultimately only divide Ukraine in two. U.S. NATO will simply rearm and reprogram the western part, and the war will restart again in a few years. What is your take, Mr. Weapons Inspector?
No, I mean, Russia talks about demilitarization, but they also talk about denazification. And everybody I've talked to who has the potential being plugged in or is plugged in to those who would make such decisions have insinuated that that the Ukrainian military will be destroyed. The Ukrainian government will be collapsed and it will be replaced with a pro-Russian government. Which through military law will govern for a period of 3 to 5 years, during which time there will be intensive denazification. Anybody who has committed a crime will be arrested and put up against in a Nuremberg type tribunal, which Russia is preparing for right now. Political parties that are linked to Stepan Bandera and not neo-Nazi ideology will be banned. And there will be a systemic process. The Russia learned from the mistakes of the 1950s when they fought these guys last time. A lot of people don't realize that from 1944 to 1953, the Red Army and the KGB fought a full-scale war with these OUN, Organization Ukrainian Nationalists, these Banderists and others, IPA. And a quarter of a million Russians were killed. 50,000 nearly Russian soldiers or Soviet soldiers and KGB security personnel were killed. 150,000 insurgents were killed. This is a major war. And 150,000 were captured. Around 200,000 fled to New York, Ellenville, Canada, where now one of them is a deputy prime minister, and on and on. But there's a large number that were put in the camps, and they were supposed to be in prison for like 25 years because of the horrible things they did. I saw a comment on there about Volyn, where the Banderas slaughtered 150,000 Poles. But today is the anniversary of a massacre in Belarus where the Banderas surrounded a village and burned the entire village to death. Only one old man survived. They have a statue in his honor there. But these are horrible, horrible, horrible people. Just disgusting people. So their ideology has to go. It's gone, and Russia won't stop until it's done. So the idea that this war is going to stop on Dnieper and the Zelensky cancer is going to be allowed to survive, let's pull the plug on that. I don't see Russia ending this conflict and letting that happen. They haven't done all this to have that outcome. Zelensky is history. The Nazis are history. There will be denazification, and Ukraine will be purged of this odious ideology once and for all.
Odious.
All right, I pronounced it Dnieper. Is that wrong? All right, got this feedback is.
I call it Dnieper, but.
All right, Kevin, you want to weigh in on that? What's the right pronunciation? Do you have a vote? Okay.
Dnieper. Kevin.
Dnieper. Okay.
Yeah, E like Irina.
Okay. All right, this is the nice woman in Switzerland who sent me 3 bottles of wine. So please shower her with love, imbue great affection in your answer, if you don't mind, Scott. Would you mind telling us again the story of your confrontation with Joe Robinette when he told you some decision was above your pay grade?
In 3 minutes. Sure. I was testifying for the U.S. Senate, a combined hearing of the Senate Foreign Relations and Senate Armed Services Committee. First time in history that happened. I was supposed to be testifying with Madeleine Albright and Cohen, the Secretary of Defense. Why? Because I was their equal when it came to understanding what was going on in Iraq, because I was at all the meetings and I was aware of everything they knew. And I knew how she lied and he lied and how they betrayed the inspectors. So we're supposed to come and explain this betrayal to the United States Senate. They bailed because they didn't want to be with me because I knew all the facts and I had all the documents. I had all the records. I was there. And so they ran. And Biden tried to shut the hearing down. He didn't want me to testify. Trent Lott, the Senate Majority Leader, kept it open. I went up there. So Biden's job was to bring me down a couple notches in front of the American people to diminish the impact of my testimony. So he sat there with his opening monologue and tried to mock me. Bottom line, it backfired. Not only did the Senate, most of the senators reject what he had to say and came to my defense, afterwards, every major newspaper attacked him. He had to write a letter of apology, which was published in the Washington Post, and he had to ask me to his office, where he spent 45 minutes in a private discussion trying to correct the record, so to speak. He claimed that he wanted to be my best buddy after that, but it, like Joe Biden always does, he lied, because later on, when I tried to approach him about the potential of going to war with Iraq over false information about weapons of mass destruction, he refused to see me, or he sent his chief of staff, who called me a traitor. That was almost fatal for him. I forced him to retract, because you don't call a Marine a traitor under any circumstances unless he's a traitor. But doing my job, being honest to the people, telling the truth, that's not a betrayal. Bottom line is Joe Biden's a lying sack of manure. He can't be trusted, and yet we elected him president of the United States.
Well, Scotty Boy didn't get in. He said he should get in. We want him to get in. It's important that he does get in.
But it's above your pay grade.
Above my pay grade. I agree, because my pay grade is pretty low.
I wonder if it's just me, but I actually didn't know Joe Biden's middle name was Robinette. When I saw that, Joe Robinette, I had to look it up. What the hell is Robinette? I said, is that, did you know that was his middle name?
No, I just don't care.
Oh, I don't know. He's the president, though. You'd think you'd know the president's middle name. I'm just curious if it's commonly known or not. I had to look it up. All right. Anyway, moving on. World of Tanks player, Germany. Some people argue that Leopard 2A46s or M1As will make a significant difference versus old T-72s that the UAF has had so far. I'm very skeptical. Ideas? Thoughts?
Look, both the Leopard and the M1A1 have 120 millimeter cannons, which are deadly. They have good fire control systems. So if they fire at a target that they've acquired and they hit it, the target's probably going to die. They're good tanks. They got good armor, but they're not invincible. They've been around a long time. It's not like these are brand new weapons that the Russians have never considered. Russia has been preparing to fight these tanks for decades, and they have anti-armor systems that are designed to defeat these tanks. And, you know, the other thing is these tanks are coming in, you know, in a Ukrainian system. It's not like, you know, the U.S. military, which has been training with the M1, knows how to use the M1, is aware of the, you know, the vagaries and the sensitivities and how often it breaks down, has to be maintained. You know, the Ukrainians are getting something they're not familiar with. And so they don't know what to expect with this weapon, and they don't know how to employ it properly. They're just going to die. That's the bottom line, is all the stuff we're giving the Ukrainians is going to end up burning on the battlefield. That's it. It will have no meaningful impact on this. People are somehow thinking that these magic brigades of Abrams and Challengers and Leopards and Martyrs and Bradleys and Strikers are going to come together, and they're going to come over the horizon and the Russians go, oh my God, we surrender, Rukiverk, you know, and they're going to run away and all that stuff. And yeah, the Russians are going to go, identification guide, Leopard, yeah. Bring up the Coronet, bam, dead. Bring up the T-90, bam, bam, dead. They're just going to kill these things because that's what the Russians are good at, killing NATO equipment.
And now we move to Anders Andersson in Sweden. Why do you think Wagner's movie The Best in Hell did not portray Ukrainians as baddies? Do Russians still believe that they can reconcile with Ukrainians? Wouldn't that be naive?
Well, you're from Sweden, so I don't know. I mean, I respect everybody's right to have an opinion, but on the issue of reconciliation, I think I'll defer to the Russians over the Swedes when it comes to, you know, whether or not reconciling with the Ukrainians is naive.
Oh, I'm sorry. That's the wrong clip. I apologize.
I got Putin.
Yeah, but that's I'm sorry.
You wanted best in. There we go. Best in hell.
Yeah.
Yeah. Look, I saw this movie, and it's an outstanding movie. If you want to get a feel for the brutality of combat in Ukraine, it's professional. They treat both sides as professionals. And that's the whole thing. They didn't. You know, there was a movie that was done about the Georgian War in 2008, and that movie portrayed the Russians as these thugs and all this kind of stuff. It's just absurd in the extreme. Here you have professionals fighting professionals in a very, you know, deadly combat. And they just told the truth. Look, I think, you know, Wagner, who made this movie, they respect the Ukrainians because Ukrainians are fighting like hell. And they are literally, you know, they're standing toe to toe. They're losing. They're dying. But they're taking a lot of guys with them. It's not like, you know, these are wimps. And I think the Russian, I'll give you an example. In Ramadi, in Iraq, when the Marines came in Ramadi in 2004, 2005, they were going up against the former Special Republican Guard of Saddam Hussein. And the Marines immediately said, these guys were fighting. They aren't amateurs. These are hardcore soldiers. Their tactics are good. They're brave. They maneuver. They communicate. They shoot. They're a tough enemy. And the Marines respected the hell out of them. They killed them. But it's not like the Marines went back and said, you know, these guys are no good. They're this, they're that, and the other thing. They said, these guys can fight. They're good fighters. And I think that's what this movie showed, is that Wagner is fighting professionals. And if you watch the movie, you'll understand the complexity. I think this movie does one of the best jobs yet of showing the complexities of modern war, how intelligence factors in, fire support factors in, the counter battery aspect of it, the drone war aspect of it, and just the brutality of close quarter combat. But, you know, I don't know if this movie was made to show that reconciliation is possible. I think this movie was put in to show the reality of the battlefield. It's the reality of the battlefield, which is the Ukrainians are professionals and they're fighting like hell. And if you make a mistake, they will kill you. This movie shows what happens when you slip up, when you make an error. A Wagner tank stays in place a moment too long, bam, dead. I mean, that's the reality. You screw up on the battlefield, you die. The Ukrainians are that good. The key to beating the Ukrainians is to be better. But to be better means you have to be really, really good, because they're pretty good too.
All right, moving on now to Darko in Macedonia. What is your opinion on the Serbia-Kosovo resolution plan, and will there be a new war in this region? Where will the Balkan countries, including Macedonia, end up on the global sphere of political influence after this war? With the Eastern or Western segment?
Well, first of all, I think what this resolution plan shows that Serbia has no intention of going to war over Kosovo right now unless pushed into an extreme situation. There's a lot of people that thought that Serbia had been pushed into that kind of extreme situation with the border dispute, the license plate dispute, registration of cars, etc. But the Serbian president backed down, and so far the Serbian people haven't revolted in protest. So it appears to me that Serbia remembers 1999 very well. And while they're a very proud people, they have rebuilt, but they understand that at the end of the day, if NATO comes back with air power, Serbia is going to be pounded again. And I just don't think they want that. I think when they look at cause and effect and risk benefit analysis, they're saying it's better to, you know, get a less than satisfactory peace than it would be to go for a futile conflict that will cause us to lose even more. So I think that's the direction they're heading. After the Ukraine conflict, I think what you're going to see is Europe's going to have to come together and figure out where it wants to go, and whether Europe can even come together after this war and be united is another question. I see Europe becoming deeply fractured. I see Europe second guessing its relationship with the United States. And I see Europe trying to create the potential for a new European security framework, which will force many nations to reevaluate. You know, as the EU starts to falter as a viable economic union, as the euro starts to falter as a viable currency, many of these Baltic or Balkan nations, which, you know, gravitated to EU, are going to say, maybe we shouldn't jump on the sinking ship. You know, I know the Titanic's big, but it got a hole in it and it's sinking. We might want to jump on this other ship over here. And that other ship's called Russia. And when people take a look at the visit of the Chinese president, the success of that visit, and the fact that Russia is now part of a trans-Eurasian economic union that's going to further invigorate its economy. If I were a Balkan state, I'd say that's the ship, that's the ride I want. That's the cruise I want to go on right there. I want to go on the fun cruise. I don't want to go on the cruise that's got COVID and it's going to be quarantined, because that's pretty much what Europe is right now. It's a diseased continent, and it's got bad stuff going on. It's got a bad captain in Joe Biden, and it's going nowhere.
Rune from Denmark. And once again, Denmark, which I gathered from Rune in Denmark. What are the rules regarding war crimes according to the Geneva Convention when there is no war declared? Now, Scott, as you may or may not know, there's actually multiple Geneva Conventions, just in case you didn't know, I thought I would tell you.
No, I know that. They tend to be encapsulated under what they call International Humanitarian Law, IHL. And IHL applies in war-like situations. You don't have to have a formal declaration of war. You have to have combatants and non-combatants, and international humanitarian law applies regardless.
Nermeen A., a Saudi in the lost West. The collective West and Ukraine's government are constantly declaring their military plans publicly. Meanwhile, Russia's military plans are kept a secret. Why does the West show its hand? Also, do you agree with Mr. Hirsch that NATO might eventually get directly involved with boots on the ground?
Well, I'll start with the second one first. I mean, Cy and I have talked about this. I think most people know that he and I count him as a friend, and I hope he counts me as a friend. And we've talked about this. He doesn't, you know, he never talks about his sources, so I don't know who his sources are. I know that he has spoken to people who say that in order, you know, when this thing goes south, as it's going south right now, we're talking about the total collapse of Ukraine in the near future, that NATO will have to do something to save face. And his sources claim that there will be boots on the ground. You know, I don't dispute that people are talking to him and he's reporting it accurately. There's no doubt about that. I have to wonder if that, you know, is actually what's going to happen, because the consequence of that is terminal. I mean, the bottom line is, when people say put boots on the ground, I always want to know what boots you're going to put on the ground. And if they say the 101st Airborne, I say, okay, that's a brigade of light infantry in a war where 37 brigades of mechanized infantry from the Ukrainians are getting chewed up on the front line now. So you're going to tell me that one brigade of American light infantry is going to turn the tide of the battle? No, Scott, we've got a striker brigade. So one brigade of light infantry and a suicide vehicle is going to turn the tide of the battle. No, Scott, we've got a heavy armor brigade. So one brigade of heavy armor is going to turn the tide of the battle. No, none of it's going to turn the tide of the battle. NATO airplanes, they'll all get shot down. I just don't see it. I don't see the magic formula that turns nothing into something. Because if you're going to put boots on the ground, you got to have something. And right now, NATO's got nothing, a big zero. General Cavoli, don't listen to me, ladies and gentlemen. Just listen to General Cavoli, 4 stars, commander of U.S. forces in Europe, supreme allied commander, speaking in Sweden in January. The violence, scope and scale of the violence of the fighting going on in Ukraine is beyond the imagination of NATO. NATO hasn't prepared for this, equipped for this, trained for this. They're not ready for it. They might be in the future, but they're not right now. So all those boots in the ground kind of guys, how do you counter that when the 4-star guy says, we ain't ready for this?
John from Arkansas. I learned a lot from watching Oliver Stone's documentary, Ukraine on Fire. Have you seen it? And would you recommend it to those interested in or unfamiliar with the lead up to the ongoing conflict in Ukraine?
Now, is this where you hit the button?
Well, it's just a brief clip. I can play it before your answer or after your answer. Should I play it before?
Play it before. Yeah, so I don't talk over. Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
NATO has expanded into 13 countries.
Почему ми так
остро реагируем на расширение НАТО. Когда страна становится членом НАТО, ей уже очень трудно сопротивляться давлению со стороны такой крупной страны, лидера НАТО, как США. И там легко появляется, может появиться все, что угодно. Система противоракетной обороны, и новые базы, и если потребуется, и новые ударные комплексы. А нам что делать?
That was Oliver Stone interviewing Putin. I think it was back in around 2014.
Yeah, 14. It was after the Maidan events. Look, let me put it this way. Somebody very, 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 very close to me had questions about Russia's role in this conflict because this person had been exposed to mainstream media. This person had been exposed to, you know, the mainstream academia. And I said, watch this movie and then come back. And this movie changed. I mean, it didn't, you know, 100%, because the person's a thinking person. So obviously the person watched it and went, that gave me a lot to think about. I have to reconsider everything. And that's good. And so what I would recommend is that everybody watch this movie. I don't want you coming out of this movie saying, I believe everything Oliver Stone put in this movie 100%. No, but I want you to say that movie made me think. There, we just won because now you're thinking. And now you're going to go out and you're going to check facts, you're going to check data, and you're basically going to, you know, develop your own independent assessment of what's going on. That's what makes a citizen. But this movie is a great place to start.
And people can watch it for free and watch it easily. It's on YouTube, so just search for it. Under the title of the film, Ukraine on Fire, you can watch the whole thing for free right on YouTube. It was on Netflix a few years ago.
Yep. But that's where I saw it. Yeah.
You know. Well, let's go to Patty Byrne from the People's Republic of Cork, Ireland. My question refers to the peace and what it will look like. Will it involve a mass migration to Russian and Ukrainian sides of the peace line? How will it guarantee the rights of every citizen? I fear that this will be a lot harder than it seems.
I mean, I don't think it's going to be that hard. I'll tell you why. I think that Ukrainian nationalism, the odious version of it, is going to be defeated. That's the hard part. The peace part's easy. People vote their pocketbooks. People vote their future. And when you take a look at, you know, which side's doing what, you know, the Ukrainians, it's just a corrupt society. It's just 110% corrupt. I'm not picking on the Ukrainian people. They're victims. But they are victims of the single most corrupt environment in Europe, where everybody has put money in the pot. You put money up here, by the time it gets down to the person, it's all been dissipated into the hands of corrupt people. There's very little left of the people, and then those people have to kick that back to get anything. It's just corrupt. I'm not saying the Russians don't have corruption. I think even the Russians will tell you, no, we got some corruption. But they're working on it. They're passing laws to go against it. They're, you know, Putin's come straight out and said, you make money in Russia, it's being reinvested in Russia. We're doing things for the good of Russia. So they're changing the approach. And I think this war has done a good job of creating a new sense of patriotism. I think the 1990s and the people that bought into the collective West's economic, manna from heaven, somehow lost faith with Russia. There's a lot of people I've talked to, they're just like, they don't believe in Russia the way that Putin believes in Russia. And they're sort of like, you know, the people in the United States and Europe who've lost a sense of national belonging. This war has reawoken it. I mean, these Russians today, of course there's some that are against it, but I think the most of them are like, I believe in Russia again. I believe in Russia. And that's a big deal to believe in Russia, which means now, if you believe in Russia, you're not going to tolerate corruption. You're not going to tolerate this nonsense. You want the things to work the way they're supposed to work. But take a look at what Russia's doing right now in the recently annexed territories. They're bringing in utilities. They're paving roads. They're building buildings. They're bringing in. They're caring for the people. They're paying the pensions of people who retired in the Ukrainian system, but now they're in Russia. They're getting Russian pensions. They didn't pay into the Russian pension system. They paid in the Ukrainian pension system, but the Russians are like, you belong to us now. We got you. Healthcare, everything. That's the Russian approach. And I think what you're going to see is when this war ends, Russia's not going to leave the people of Ukraine festering. They're not. I mean, there's a, you know, there's some bitterness. I'm sure there is. And their number one priority is always going to be Russia. But they don't want cancer living next door to them because that disease can migrate. So Russia's going to be working overtime to make sure that the Ukrainian people are taken care of. And that's how you ensure peace. And making sure that people wake up in the morning and believe that the people in responsibility are going to take care of us, that we're going to be given power. We're going to have access to medical care. We're going to have access to, you know, electricity. Ouch. So I have confidence in Russia. Look, this is the most mature adult government I've seen in the world today. I can't talk about China because I don't know them perfectly.
Well, you can't talk to you're out of time.
You didn't hit me with the second one.
Well, I'm telling you verbally.
Wow.
Okay, so let's do one more pre-submitted question and then take some live questions from our curator extraordinaire, Kevin Michalitzi. Questions coming in live on YouTube and Facebook. And if you want to submit your question in advance for the next episode, you can do that at scottritterextra.com. David Ulbolher from Tijuana. People I care about are stuck in a refugee camp near Zhytomyr. They've been told they must fight till the last Ukrainian dies. What is their hope?
Well, who told them that? I mean, the people who run the refugee camp, the Ukrainian government, Lindsey Graham. You know, it depends on the source of the thing for me to say what their hope is. But the bottom line is, do you believe in Ukraine or do you not believe in Ukraine? And when I say believe in Ukraine, do you believe in Ukraine as it's manifested under Zelensky? And if you do, then you get the hell out of the refugee camp and you go fight till you die. That's what you do. That's what you believe in. But the fact that you're in a refugee camp, now, if you're a woman and a child, of course you're in a refugee camp. But if you're a man of adult age, why are you in a refugee camp? It implies that you maybe don't believe in the system enough to give your life for it. Then you have to ask the question, what are you going to do when they come for you? Are you going to go or are you going to stand up and resist? Are there going to be enough for you to create, critical mass? In the United States, we got tired of taxation without representation. We got tired of British troops coming into our house. We got tired of the king treating us like scum. So we had a revolution and we made ourselves independent. Cost a lot. Wasn't easy, but we did it. If there's enough Ukrainians right now that are unhappy with what's going on, why the hell are you just sitting there doing nothing? I mean, especially if you're a man with a family, get your family safe. But, do you think all the colonial guys who went and fought in the colonial army, that their women and children were safe? No. I mean, this is war. So everybody's involved. There's risk for everybody. But if you're unhappy with the Zelensky government, damn it, do something about it. Take them on. Find like-minded souls. Apparently, there's a lot of soldiers that aren't happy about going to the meat grinder. So turn on the nationalist battalions. Why do you let Idair and Typhoon and all these things intimidate you? Go in and slit their throats at night. Put a bull in their head. Charge them. Kill them. Do something. Take their weapons, then march on Kiev. Don't sit here and bitch and moan about being a refugee camp because you're afraid you're a person. Come on, that's how mice die. Die like a man, at least.
Okay. And while Kevin lines up our question, let me just – oh, you already got it. All right. We'll go to the questions. Sergey, our friend, who is a very regular viewer and a very consistent contributor financially. We thank you for that, Sergey. Now that Iran and the Saudis are making amends, will the U.S. now support whichever Yemeni faction just to keep that wound bleeding?
I don't know how the U.S. can continue to support the conflict in Yemen without Saudi Arabian participation. If the Saudis and the Iranians are able to find a path towards a resolution of this conflict appeases the Houthi, that implies that the Saudis are going to be able to put pressure on the faction that they support, and there will be some sort of reconciliation. So I think that's the direction they're heading. If you can get that, then there won't be anybody for the U.S. to latch on to. So I think the U.S. has been riding the Saudi coattails for this conflict. Helping them out, but that was their entree in. It's not like they have an independent entree in. So I think if Saudi Arabia and Iran are able to make good on this, then the U.S. is just boxed out and it's over.
Okay. And then while Kevin's lining up the next question, just want to tell folks they can get Scott's autographed book at scottrittermerch.com. You can also link to it from the Substack, and he will personally walk it to the post office for you. Okay, go ahead, Kevin. AUKUS will make Australia the Germany of, or Austria the Germany of the Pacific Theater. Can you rant about the stupidity of my vassal government?
I could easily rant about the stupidity of your vassal government. Your government is dumber than dirt, and the military professionals who are advising your government should resign and be, you know, kicked out and humiliated and all that goes with it. You know, you guys had a great prime minister who was very, very, he's the guy that basically opened up relations with China. Keating, I think, might be his last name. He just did a press conference, his national press center in Australia. And he just, it was hilarious to watch because every reporter came up and you know how reporters are so pompous and full of themselves. And he just shot him down. You're stupid. Your brain doesn't work. You wrote, I read your article. You're dumber than dirt. Da, da, da. And everything was spot on. But he made the following point. The Australian Navy could have had 40 Collins class submarines, diesel, quiet, able to operate in the shallow waters off of Australia. 40. It means you can protect Australia, which is what sort of the Australian Defense Force should be doing, protecting Australia. And you exchange that for 4 American nuclear submarines, which are too big to operate in your waters, which means you're going to be doing 4 defense of what? The number one threat to Australia is its supply link to China. I mean, they totally dependent upon China and all that. So they've hired 4 submarines to protect their supply link to China from the Chinese. How retarded is this? Literally, it's the most retarded thing in the world. The Australian government is stupid. They've sold their soul to the United States. And why are you selling your soul to the United States? When was the last time we did anything clever? I mean, we won World War II. Okay, I'm in the Pacific Theater. I get it. We saved you. You owe us a lot for that. But then we got you into Vietnam. How smart was that? Then we got you into the Gulf. How smart was that? We got you in Afghanistan. Pretty stupid. A good friend of mine died in Afghanistan with the SAS. Hey, I'm not too happy about that. You know, we can go on and on and on about all the stupid things you've done for the United States. And now you've done the most stupid thing in the world. Join us. You know, because it's 3. AUK us. And let's take out the AUK because the AUK is the United Kingdom. And we know that if they take their entire army, put into a soccer stadium, you still have 30,000 unsold seats. That's how pathetic they are. They don't have a fleet. You think the British fleet is coming to save you? There is no fleet. You might get 1 or 2 ships and they'll get sunk day one from the Chinese. How stupid are you? Australia, wake the blank up. This is dumb. You don't need America. We only bring poison. We're horrible. Yeah, our Marines really enjoy going on liberty in Australia because you guys are fun to drink with and your women are pretty. But other than that, why the hell would you want to be our friend? We don't respect you. We're only using you. That's all you are to us. You're a big aircraft carrier in the South of the Pacific that we're going to use to launch our ill-thought-out conflict with China. And then in the end, we'll leave you like we leave everybody else. You'll be left a rotted corpse, just like we left Afghanistan and we're going to leave Ukraine because we don't like you. We're just using you.
All right. You asked for a rant and you got a rant. Dumber than dirt, but are they odious?
Not yet. Maybe some of their policies are. We don't know.
All right. Sparty Matt, thanks for the donation. Random question. I've seen Operation Paperclip being excused, justified by saying the Soviets did the same thing. How true is that claim? I find it hard to believe that Soviets had a cordial relationship with Nazi scientists.
Well, they didn't do the exact same thing, but they did. I mean, you know, Operation Paperclip is, of course, how we brought the Soviet scientists over, primarily Wernher von Braun and his whole V2 program came over and became the basis of NASA, and they helped get us to the moon. It happened, you know, the Soviets went in and got a whole bunch of their version of scientists, and they brought them back. And outside of Moscow, on an island, they set up a camp, and they had their own the initial research department, you know, design bureau for Korolev's rockets were German scientists. And then what the Russians did or Soviets did is they said, okay, we're going to look what the Germans are doing, and then we're going to sit over here and we're going to replicate it so it's Soviet only. And at the appropriate time, they went, yeah, we got this one. We're done with you guys. go home. And they sent them home. You know, they didn't stay. We didn't have there was no Soviet von Braun that stayed on to guide them. They used the scientists. They sucked the life out of there. There were some good relations. Some of the Germans married some Russians. Some of them stayed on. But most of them went home to their families, returned to East Germany, and went on. So I think there's a little bit difference in scope and scale of how the United States absorbed the Nazis and how Russia used them from a scientific standpoint and then sent them back. I think by 1955, 1956, the Soviets were done with the Nazis. Meanwhile, in America, Wernher von Braun is getting promoted and everybody else is getting promoted as well. So I think there's a difference between paperclip and what the Soviets did. But no, the Soviets did have a cooperative and even some place would say cordial relationship with the German scientists.
Turlaw Irwin. Dear Scott, when is the next episode of the Scott Ritter Show? That's the collaboration with your media partners in Moscow.
Yes. Well, here's the thing. Everybody thinks that I'm some sort of all-powerful person that, you know, I'm being paid by the Russians and they're just doing whatever I want. It's not how it works. The very limited support I get from Russia was overwhelmed by Xi Jinping's visit. And we didn't have the show last week because of preparations for this. And this week, instead of me hosting a show, I actually went on and was interviewed by somebody associated with the Solovyov Network. So I became the guest to their show. And next week, I think we might do something on Monday. That's what we're looking at Monday. But again, they're just overwhelmed right now. This Xi Jinping thing has eaten up experts, and they're frankly tired. And believe it or not, I don't have the pull to pick up the phone and say, damn it, I want to do the show now, and I need the expert now. I'm at the whim and mercy of whatever's available in Russia. So hopefully Monday we'll do something. If not, we'll do it when we do it. We're trying to find ways to do it better, come up with, better ways to make, to make sure, because you literally got the world's most amateurish host hosting it. And I just sit there and I stare at a camera and I don't do jack squat. Now, the show depends on great guests, and I've been blessed with having great guests. But now, is the guest pool, when the guest pool, I'm not going to say finishes, but we have to bring in somebody that people don't automatically know. Sometimes you got to have some bells and whistles and frills and videotape and stuff like that. And we're not there yet. We don't have that production value yet. So we're working on it, but I think Monday will be the next episode of it.
All right. Well, at least unlike the host of this show, you know the difference between Austria and Australia, or at least the difference between the way it's abbreviated. We constantly adapt to circumstances. Speaking of schedule changes, that's why we're on today on a Wednesday. Usually we do the lightning round on Tuesdays. And the second show, the loquacious version, is usually Friday nights. But this week it'll be tomorrow night. So for the first time ever, 2 days in a row of Ask the Inspector. Join us again live tomorrow night at 8 p.m. Eastern time. And then next week, I think we might have to switch things around a bit too, but let's take it one step at a time. Ian Myers. Hello, Scott and Jeff. Will your Russian tour take you to
Chelyabinsk?
Say it again.
I say Chelyabinsk, but it could be something else.
Well, there's another one right after it, or
Chelyabinsk, Yekaterinburg.
Yeah. No to the first, yes to the second, tentatively. Yekaterinburg is a city in the Ural Mountains, or a little bit east of the Urals, where Tsar Nicholas and his family was killed. It's a city with some history, and it's also a city where the KGB or the FSB has their hacker academy, I think. It's where the guys who learn how to hack computers go to school. So maybe I could go there and get a tour of where the Tsar died and somebody can teach me how to hack computers. I don't know. We'll see what happens.
All right. We have time for just a couple more questions. Calm the dude. How is Russia, with a $66 billion annual military budget, doing so good against NATO, who has a $1.1 trillion annual budget?
Well, two things. One, when we say $66 billion, then we have to convert that into what they call purchasing, let's see, PPP, purchasing power parity. So it's a way of converting to actual what the equivalent purchasing power of that. That's 66 US dollar equivalents. But if you convert into how you turn that into what it costs in Russia and how the Russian system works, that number actually goes up, not to 1.1 trillion, but it goes up somewhat. The other thing is, the Russians, while, you know, their defense industries make a profit, their motive isn't to make profit. This isn't Raytheon. This isn't General Dynamics. This isn't Lockheed Martin. This isn't General Motors. This isn't any of the defense industries in the United States or in Europe, where the bottom line is the bottom line. Are we making money? Or are we not making money? We don't do this for patriotism. We do this to make money. Russia does it for patriotism. They do it to serve the country. They do it to, you know, make the best possible piece of equipment for the Russians at the most reasonable price. They do make a profit. No one's pretending they don't make a profit. But if you take a look at their research and development timelines, they have a quicker turnaround. They don't have, you know, very rare is the Russian system that they run into what we run into, you know. They break delivery dates, cost overruns, the thing costs this much and then it becomes this much. That's not how the Russians work. I mean, there's some concern with like T-14 Armada. There's some concerns that that's an expensive tank that may not function the way it wants. But I just think it's more like it's an expensive tank that's tough to mass produce with a limited budget. But now the Russians seem to, there's some indication that they may start producing more of the T-14. So we'll see. But I think the Russians get more bang for the buck. Look, when the Pentagon does an audit, it says, we don't know where $1 trillion went. That's a problem. I don't imagine that the Russians are going to have an audit and go, we don't know where $1 trillion went. No. So I just think they get bigger bang for the buck. There's more efficiency. And that's why they're able to do more with less.
Okay, let's do one more question. Paul Wolf, which city will fall first, Adivka or Bakhmut?
Ooh, Paul. I don't know, man. That's a horse race. But do you want my bet? My bet is Adivka will fall first because Ukrainians haven't put everything into that defense, and it's a rapidly developing situation that the Russians, I believe, are going to be able to exploit. Bakhmut is just a fight. The Ukrainians are doubling down on that, tripling down, putting everything in there. So they're scratching and screaming. Adivka, on the other hand, they're fighting, but I just think that sort of popped up. Everyone, whoop, damn, the Russians are threatening to encircle us. And I think there's something up further, Seversk or something there, where the Russians are also doing the same. And I'm pretty sure even further north, there's going to be another thing like that, because the Russians are attacking all along the line, and they're putting pressure on the Ukrainians all along the line. And the Ukrainians just don't have enough reserves to plug every gap. So what we're seeing now is the success of the Russian strategy of just putting pressure. Everybody's like, when does the offensive begin? I've been saying for some, it's already happened, guys. It's been ongoing. The Russians are just sitting there pressuring the whole line. They probe here, probe there, probe here, probe there, probe there. And the Ukrainians are parceling out their reserves to try and contain things, throwing everything into Bakhmut. And all of a sudden, Adivka, encircle when possible. Seversk, they might get summed up by Limon. Who knows? But what we're seeing is the collapse of the Ukrainian defense.
Okay, so as I said, tomorrow we're going to do another podcast, not Friday night this week, Thursday instead, and adult beverages optional, as we usually do on Friday, but this time it'll be on Thursday at 8 p.m. Eastern time. That's because Scott will be traveling to Washington, D.C. on Friday for an event there Saturday, and if you go to scottritterextra.com/uncancelled, you can see all our event info, including that particular event. And then we're going to be in Texas later in the month. Same thing. Go to scottritterextra.com for the info and to reserve your spot at these events. That first one, March 28th, is at a private residence. Some folks were a little bit unclear about that, but that is open to the public, even though it is at a private residence. And you can buy Scott's autographed book at scottrittermerch.com. And was there anything else that we have to say, or is that pretty much covered?
Let me just make another pitch for Saturday, and I'll make it again. This is a conference put on by Caleb Maupin's people, CPI, and I'll be speaking about arms control. And I think it's just an important conversation to have. So if anybody's in the Washington, D.C. area, come to the website, find the location, and show up. And I'll hang around and answer questions all day long. I mean, I'm going there for this purpose. So if you wanted to have a chance to corner me and talk to me, here it is. So show up and support. I think it's free, free, open to the public. I don't want to say that too loudly because it may not be. But
well, you know what? We have organizer Caleb coming on as our guest tomorrow night. So we
can, right, we'll talk. Yeah, we'll talk to him about
that. We can get all the details then. Okay, and then one more time, remind folks, Scott's latest article is on energy intelligence, and you can find that on scottritterextra.com, where we link to it. Thanks to Kevin Michalitzi for the great job backstage. Thanks to our beloved audience. And thank you, my favorite weapons inspector. All the best. See you soon. See you tomorrow.
Citizen Jeff. Okay.
The one and only, baby.
The one and only.